Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
This is Lily Gorin with the New Books Network, the New Books in Political Science podcast. Today, I'm joined by Lynn Vavreck, one of the three authors on the very popular new book, Identity Crisis, the 2016 Presidential Campaign and the Battle for the Meaning of America. Dr. Vavreck wrote this book with John Sides and Michael Tesler. Identity Crisis was just published by Princeton University Press and dives into the 2016 election with an eye to explaining what actually happened, not just in the election, but also in the campaign and what was going on in the United States that provided the context for what was an unexpected outcome on election night in 2016. Vavreck, Sides, and Tesler come to explore the tensions around American identity and what it means to be an American today, but also how that very idea is contested and more seen through partisan lenses. But I will let Lynn dive into this as we discuss identity crisis. First, I would like to welcome Lynn Vavreck to the New Books in Political Science podcast and to ask her to tell us a little bit about herself and about how she and her co-authors came to this project. Hello, Lynn.
Hi.
Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
Should I just jump right in?
You should just jump right in.
Okay. Well, I have spent quite a while studying campaigns and elections and have always been interested in the question of whether the things that candidates say and do in campaigns affects voters on election day. So in a lot of ways, this book is a natural next step for someone who's interested in those things. But it's an unusual step in that it is meant to be a public-facing book, so accessible to people who are interested in politics, people who are practitioners, not only to political scientists who are in the academy. So it's not the first one like that that John Sides and I have done. We wrote a book in 2012 called The Gamble, which was a similar style of book, taking political science methods and research and applying it to understanding what happened in 2012. And we thought we would do that again in 2016. But in this case, we brought on a third co-author, Michael Tesler, to help us with what we thought was going to be the gender component of the story. Michael is a scholar of race and politics and identities more generally, but has written two books on the Obama elections. And then, as you know, I guess you would say luck would have it, we ended up with one of the world's leading scholars of race and politics helping us on our book about an election that was all about race and identity. So we got lucky there.
Well done. So you came to this project to some degree then as a follow-on that you anticipated from the 2012 project. But it turned out to be a little bit different than you anticipated. Is that correct?
Well, that's for sure. Yes.
So the overarching theme, as I was reading through the book, seems to be about the cleaving of American identity as concepts of that identity more and more line up along partisan demarcations. Was this what you all anticipated as you set out to examine the 2016 presidential cycle?
Well, no. As I mentioned, we, along with almost everyone else in the world, thought that the outcome of the 2016 election was going to be the election of the first woman president of the United States. All the indications from fundamental models about the economy to poll aggregating that takes advantage of the daily polls, all of those methods indicated that Hillary Clinton and the Democratic Party would have an advantage in this election. So that's what we thought was going to happen. The book we wrote in 2012, The Gamble, very much told the story of a regular election that looked a lot like what was predicted to happen, despite the fact that every other day someone was reporting on a game changer. And so we coined the phrase in that book, game samer, that all these things that people think are so consequential are actually only moving the needle for that one day. And then everything comes back. So there weren't any game-changing moments. In 2016, you can't write that book again.
No.
So we knew we couldn't write the same book. So we thought that there was an opportunity to tell the story about how a woman becomes president of the United States. So that is really what we thought we were going to be writing about. And of course, then she does get more votes, but not more electoral college votes. And so that's really the moment where we have to go back to the table and say, okay, the story of this election is no longer how a woman becomes president. It is how this particular man, this unusual candidate, wins the Republican nomination. We pretty quickly realized that the whole story, the interesting story of 2016, was how Donald Trump was able to get that Republican nomination. Because once you're the Republican nominee, partisans behave like partisans. And they came out and voted for their candidates in 2016, largely in the same way that they do in previous elections. So the really interesting part was about him winning the nomination. Now, the book also goes to the general election, but in terms of how we reframed immediately, that's where we went.
So following up on that aspect, which I thought was a really fascinating component of the book, taking me all the way back to sort of the sort of quieter days on some level of the nomination fight, you focus on how identity is coming forward within the Republican Party, but it's not sort of fitting into a lot of the usual places. Can you talk a little bit more about that nomination process that we saw with regard to Trump and the many people who ran against him?
So we call the book Identity Crisis because we think there are multiple identity crises happening in 2016. And one of them is in the Republican Party. The other ones are in the country writ large. This struggle during the 2016 campaign and the aftermath around the question of what kind of country do we want to be? Does America want to be a country that is inclusive of others and people who are different or exclusive of those people? So that's one crisis. And then the other one is happening in the Democratic primary. But the one that you're asking about is the crisis in the Republican Party. And so what is that? And how we basically tell that story is about the difference between where the mass public is on a lot of issues relating to immigration, for example, trade, and where Republican Party elites are on those issues. And in this case, the Republican Party elites have more liberal positions on these issues than the Republican mass electorate. So elites have been a little bit out of step with the party on these things, but the elites have been homogenous. They've been the same, more or less. Then along comes Donald Trump in 2016. He comes down that escalator in the summer of 2015 and says, Mexicans are rapists. They're not sending their best. And then a couple days later, he says, build a wall. And a couple days later, he says, we're going to make a list of Muslims. And he has all this exclusionary rhetoric that signals to people in the mass electorate, what his positions are on these issues. And he is going to where a significant chunk of Republican Party voters already are. So we call it in the book, he went hunting where the ducks are.
Yep. Yep.
So we create those attitudes. They have always existed. It's just that most Republican elites have been out of step with those attitudes. And it hasn't been contested in these nominations. And along comes Trump and he says, I know there are people right here and I'm going to go and I'm going to get their votes. And the 16 other of you, you guys can divide up the other 70% of the country.
And go ahead. Go ahead.
No, I mean, that's the story of how he's able to, you know, people think, was it, you know, did he sort of persuade people? No. Are people, you know, persuaded by him because he's a television star? There might be things about his celebrity that we can talk about, but in this particular case, people held these attitudes and he gave them a voice in a way that no other Republican contenders were going to do.
And that part of your book I thought was really interesting in terms of diving into what you sort of say is already existed. It was just not something that politicians, for the most part, had been sort of using or unearthing in a lot of ways.
Well, it was just seen as, you know, you couldn't do that. You couldn't explicitly talk about these racial attitudes that people hold in both parties. You know, after the 1988 campaign, when the Bush campaign made an ad called the Revolving Door ad, and they were accused of playing the race card implicitly. After that, it was just seen as something that politicians could not do.
And so into that, you sort of start to unpack this question of identity, the voter identities, and individuals' own identities and how those, to some degree, become woven together with political identities, particularly partisan political identities, which also leads to a kind of clarifying understanding of white identity. Can you explain how this aspect of identity kind of came into focus, given the extensive data and analysis you were all working with in exploring the election?
So the only reason that identity is playing a role in 2016, a different role than it played in 2012 or 2008, is because Donald Trump raises it and then Hillary Clinton joins that conversation to counter his claims. So the candidates are talking about it. That is why identity gets activated. And Trump does something really interesting. He not only talks about explicit identity issues like immigration, but he then refracts all kinds of issues through the lens of identity. So when he wants to talk about jobs, which every presidential candidate since the history of, you know, the modern era talks about jobs. But when Donald Trump wants to talk about jobs in 2016, he's not just saying, are you afraid of losing your job? He says, you're afraid of losing your job to an immigrant. They're coming here and they're taking your jobs. They're cutting in front of you in line. They're taking your benefits. He makes everything about identity. And there have been presidential candidates who have done that successfully around other issues, like John Kennedy and the Great Frontier. So he wove every issue, refracted every issue through this idea that the Soviets were beating us. It was an all-out war for the future of the world, and the Soviets were winning it. And that was in math and science, in missile production. And Trump is doing the same thing, but through a lens of identity. So he's making everything about that. And Clinton, who, you know, she gets sucked into this conversation, quite frankly, in a lot of the same ways that Nixon got sucked in to the conversation in the 1960s with John Kennedy. At one point, Nixon says, you know, high hopes, new frontiers, we all have high hopes. You know, he's adopting the language of Kennedy in the same way that Hillary Clinton hears what Donald Trump is saying, and she wants to counter it. And so she's in that discourse with him. You know, we are not going to build a wall. She's saying his things. And once that starts happening, those attitudes that people hold are going to be activated. They're going to become more important in people's decision making. And some people are mismatched. There are a lot of people, white voters, who voted for Barack Obama in 2012 who switch and vote for Donald Trump. And people think this is a mystery, but a lot of them are mismatched with the Democratic Party on something like immigration. We have a question in our data set. Do you think, you know, agree or disagree, illegal immigrants are a drain on society? And if I asked you to guess the percentage of white Obama voters in 2012 who agreed with that statement, illegal immigrants are a drain on society, I don't think a lot of people would guess 34%, but that's the number. And so those people are out of step with the Democratic Party, certainly the Democratic Party of 2016, on immigration. And along comes Donald Trump and says, hey, immigrants are a drain on society. And so if you're one of these people, and this issue is now becoming the issue that this election is going to be contested around, you switch. And not all of them switch, but some of them do.
Yeah, and we recently had the election here. I'm in Wisconsin, and we have definitely Walker voters and Baldwin voters. So they may be still mismatched in some places. But of course, Wisconsin was one of the parts of the blue wall that fell, as you note in the book. So I was wondering, to follow up on some of this, can you walk us through at least a broad understanding of the data? And there is a lot of data in your book, that you all explored and analyzed, and how these data sets provided the basis for your analysis?
Sure. So we've got data on people, and we've got data on campaign advertising, or what the candidates are saying, basically. And we've got data on the news and how the news is reporting the election. And those are the three basic sets of things that we're going to use to tell a story. The data on people are, I think they're the most interesting. All these data sets are interesting, but this one is pretty good. So we took the data that we collected in 2012 to write the other book, The Gamble, and we re-interviewed 8,000 people who we first talked to in 2011. And this is a project that was funded by the Democracy Fund, and it's called, the acronym is the VOTER Project. And that stands for something, off the top of my head, I don't know what the acronym, you know, voters and the election, and I, you know, but it spells out the word voter. So the Democracy Fund went and re-interviewed these people. So we have them in 11 and 12. And then we have them again in 13, and then in 15, 16, 17, and 18, 8,000 people.
Wow.
So what we can do, what makes this interesting, is we can take their attitudes in 2011, before Donald Trump, long before he comes down that escalator and starts saying what he's saying. We can take people's attitudes, like these people who were saying that illegal immigrants are mostly a drain on society, in 2011. And then we can say, given that that was your attitude back then, who are you voting for in 2016? So we're preventing one very important thing from happening. The fact that people in 2016 might hear what Donald Trump is saying, and then they might adopt his policy positions. They might say, yeah, I think that too. I think we should build a wall. And then all of a sudden, it looks like, if you just do the correlation, it looks like Donald Trump really tapped into something. Look at 80% of his supporters want to build the wall. And it turns out that they didn't want to build the wall before he said it. They only want to say, they say that now because he said it. And if you're for him, you believe this. So we make the mistake of thinking that people had these positions before. The people do this with the exit polls all the time. On election night, they ask people, you know, why did you vote the way you did? And people say X, Y, and Z. And the inference is that because they hold position X, Y, and Z, they voted for candidate A. And what's really going on in a lot of those cases is exactly the opposite. Because they voted for candidate A, they're telling you that X, Y, and Z were really important to them. So we're preventing that confound from happening by using attitudes that were collected in 2011 and 12. So that's a really neat resource for us. And we leverage that a lot throughout the whole book.
And this, of course, gives you the perspective of what you were talking about that as I said, it sort of comes forward throughout the book that this context, this understanding of some of the antagonisms towards other citizens and other people in the United States were all there. It was one of, as you note, sort of Trump's capacities to leverage that to his advantage during the election. But I wanted to also ask you a little bit more on the data, the other data that you used in the book with regard to the media. You also noted that one of the things you're interested in is, you know, sort of how rhetoric influences or may influence people. Can you talk a little bit about what you saw with regard to the media in the analyses that you looked at?
Sure. So the media data are basically tracking the prevalence of stories and the prevalence of mentions of the candidates over time. And there are two basic patterns that are interesting. In the primaries, for example, when Donald Trump's share of the news coverage would go up, he would gain vote share. Now, his gaining vote share is also making his share of media go up, so there's some recursiveness there. But we try really hard to separate out what's driving what. And it seems like in the primaries, the better he does in the news, the better he does in the polls. But by the time we get to the general election, the result is the opposite. In the general election, when Donald Trump is gaining share of news, his poll numbers are going down. And that's a pattern that we saw in 2012 as well. In the primaries, sometimes party is playing less of a role in the primaries, and so all sorts of other things come to play. But in the general election, party identification is really structuring the vote. And so if you're getting covered for endless one after the other scandals, that is going to take a little bit of the shine off of the polls. And so we talk about this in the book by saying, you know, this election should be close. The fundamentals of the election, the slow growth rate in the economy, the fact that there's not an incumbent president running, all of that leads to a very, very close prediction, a slight Democratic win. The election wants to be close, but Donald Trump won't let it because it was never close over the course of the 2016 campaign. Clinton was out ahead at some point by double digits. Now, nobody really thought she was going to win by double digits. But the reason that that gap existed was not that, quote unquote, polls are broken. It was that Trump was always out there saying something outrageous. And when he would get covered for that, his poll share would drop. And then you get close to election day and a couple of interesting things happen. And just to preview that a little bit, elections always get closer near election day. Partisans come home, it tightens up. That's just a regular finding. We expected to see that. But on top of that, something else happened. When the Comey letter comes out, the Trump campaign makes the decision to take Trump's phone away. And so they don't let him tweet. And even he sort of looks like he buys into this idea that he just needs to be quiet and let this play out. And without him out there saying outrageous things, the poll numbers go to the equilibrium outcome that where we expected, to a very, very close race. And all the rest of it before, where it looks like she's ahead by a lot, that's an artifact of Trump doing and saying outrageous things to get in the news and taking a hit in the polls because of it.
So the actually taking his phone away had the effect that his campaign wanted it to have.
Yeah.
Yeah. but they haven't done that since then, really, for the most part. I wanted to follow up because the book is named, you know, Identity Crisis. And there's a lot of discussion of identity. What do you and John and Michael mean or intend with regard to this concept of identity. I mean, there's a discussion of white identity. There's a discussion of, you know, other group identity. And also that once you are coalescing into a particular group, that there may be, as you say in the introduction, a kind of growing hostility towards other groups that have different identities.
Right. So that's, I would say, the most important place to start, is that we are squarely talking about social identities. And what that means is identities that are about in-groups and out-groups. So how you see yourself, that's the basic idea of identity. Who are you? You know, are you a student, a teacher, a mother, a wife, a husband, a best friend? You could be a lot of things. You could be a lawyer, a dentist, but those may or may not be social identities. They're probably not social identities. Social identities are about groups. So an easy way to think of it is, I'm a Browns fan, a Cleveland Browns fan. And so I'll pause for a moment and you can all feel sorry for me.
My husband's a Bengals fan, you know.
There you go. So you understand my struggle. But I have been a Browns fan my whole life. Me and Condoleezza Rice, apparently.
Me and Condoleezza Rice.
That is woven up in my pre-adult socialization. It's the house I grew up in. It's how I bonded with my dad. And so that's always going to be a part of me. And when I see people wearing Pittsburgh Steelers jerseys, I know I'm not like them. I say, I'm a Browns fan. They're a Steelers fan. And I immediately, you know, sort of sink into this us versus them mentality. And it's easy. Sports are an easy way to think about this, because it's very easy to know who's in your group, because you can do things like wear jerseys or, you know, signal with colors. And it's very easy to know who's in the other group. And then being in those groups gets woven up with a whole bunch of other things about the members. So for a Browns, you know, you're from the Rust Belt. The dog pound is like a great way to think about what it means to be a Browns fan. So there's stuff that goes with it. It's the same thing with other kinds of social identities that are not sports based. So your race, religion, gender, ethnicity, could think of a whole bunch of different groups. And those are the kinds of identities that we're talking about. Social identities around race, ethnicity, religion, and gender that were highlighted by Trump in this election.
And as you say, they were not only highlighted by Trump, but they were also highlighted by Clinton in conversation with Trump and in trying to define herself as well.
That's exactly right. So, you know, the in-group, Trump is, he is just, you know, good at this. He does it all the time. Us versus them. We, he'll say at his rallies, we know. And sometimes the they are going to be the, you know, those progressives or those liberals, those people who are trying to get into the country, the Democrats, the people who live in the big cities. You know, sometimes the they is the media. He'll point right at them and say they. He's turned being a journalist into a social identity.
He has.
You know, he has done that. And it's just, you know, he's making meaning around these social identities in a way that is hard to do, but and presidential candidates usually don't engage in it. But he is doing it. And when Hillary Clinton comes into this conversation and starts pushing back, defending those women in her advertisements, defending the daughters, the girls who are hearing Trump say all these things about women, she is helping to define who the other is, the outsider, the they. And so she's a part of how this election gets separated on these identities.
And so there's to some degree, what your research is showing is that it was very difficult for anybody running against Trump, because of what is already existing in the country, to sort of not, to some degree, fall into that trap.
Yeah, I don't know who could have run against him and not wanted to push back in that way. If you think about the Republican primary, how did they push back? Well, the answer is they didn't. So, you know, They are very late to attack Trump. We have, this is another one of my favorite parts of the book. We show how long it took for the one of the 16 other Republican contenders to start attacking Trump in earnest. And it's like South Carolina after South Carolina, even. He's basically getting the nomination by that point. And I think the reason that they're slow to really seriously, they're attacking each other.
Right.
So they're all, you know, and again, not hard to imagine why they're doing this. You know, Bush is attacking Rubio. They're all worried about each other because they're sure it's not going to end up being Trump. So therefore it's going to end up being one of us. And so you're worried about who the competition is within this other set. But in a way, they took their eye a little bit off the ball because they're not attacking Trump. Now, I don't know what would have happened if they had all put their resources, instead of on attacking each other, into attacking him, or how they would have done it. But my guess is that they would have started to push back on some of the same things that Clinton is pushing back on.
But it would have been internal in terms of the party, as opposed to the sort of cross party or opposite party sort of situation, which brings me to one of my next questions. One of the reoccurring findings that I found really interesting was what there seemed to be an almost immediate backlash to the kind of antagonistic political rhetoric from both candidate Trump and then subsequently President Trump, because you sort of go forward towards the end of the book to what happened after he got elected.
Right.
You all pay attention to the shifting opinions about Muslims and immigrants, African Americans, especially following denigrating rhetoric or comments. Does this backlash have long-term effects within our political environment?
Well, it does. And there's on the one hand and on the other hand. So on the one hand, on average, the country is becoming more liberal on all these things. So the backlash is on average moving things in a more liberal direction. On the other hand, that average liberalization is coming at the hands of Democrats. So Democrats are becoming even more liberal on these things, and Republicans aren't moving. So the gap between Democrats and Republicans is widening. There's always been a gap, but it is growing. And in some cases, it's 35, 45, 50 points on these identity issues. And so on average, things are getting more inclusive, but the crisis of identity, that we feel so different from one another socially, culturally, and politically, that is getting exacerbated because the difference between people is growing.
And that was one of the points that I found really fascinating towards the end of the book, that you highlight the sort of partisan polarization that's going on simultaneously with more favorable views of the groups that Trump attacks. But that what happens in this world where both of these things are true is unclear. And I don't know that the election 2 weeks ago has made it any more clear, but do you and John and Michael have some thoughts on that?
On whether the alignment of party and identity is continuing or disappearing?
Well, if it's continuing, and also if it is continuing, which I think it is, but you all are the experts, then what do we do?
Oh, I see. The hard question.
The hard question.
It is. I think definitely identity, immigration in particular, played a bigger role in 2018 than it did in 2016, or, for example, in congressional elections in 2014. So we are still feeling this. Now, it's one thing to say it played a bigger role, meaning that it's separating people. It is a dimension on which choices are being made. It's a bigger dimension. There's a difference between saying that and saying it's causing people to switch around and vote counter to party. So the latter part, we saw a lot of that shifting happening in 2016 because immigration was not really an issue in 2012 or 2014, and it was not one that the candidates were that different on. But in 2016, they were. So you see that first shifting and sifting happening. But now it can continue to play a big role without there being surprises, because there will be fewer people who are sorting on this issue for the first time. Okay, so what do we do about it? The hard question. I think historically, if we look, there are always backlash moments that come. And so eventually we will move beyond the divisions of identity into a discourse and a time when people are trying to leverage unity. I don't know when that's going to come. I'm hopeful that it comes in my lifetime. It might not, but I think it probably will. It requires entrepreneurial politicians who see that as an opportunity to gain advantage, to essentially make the conversation about something else. So for example, Sherrod Brown in Ohio is talking about the dignity of work. Now that's an interesting idea, an interesting possibility for how to start a new conversation about identity, but identity built around something other than race, ethnicity, religion, or gender. An identity built around the work that you do. And that is something everybody can relate to. And it's, you know, I think it'll be interesting to see if he runs for president and if he's able to parlay that idea of the dignity of work into something really big, a la John Kennedy's ideas around the new frontier, for example. So that's I think, what happens next.
So that immigration itself as a policy sort of bifurcation has now more clearly sorted people into partisan alliances that make some sense, is also what this identity around immigration has highlighted. Is that correct?
Well, I don't know that I would say it makes sense, but people are not mismatched to their party on immigration. They've either changed their attitude on immigration or they changed their party on average.
Okay. So I was intrigued as reading through this whole book, and I was wondering, I wonder what was surprising. So I'm going to ask you that.
Well, the result I talked about earlier, there's a table in the book with several results about white Obama voters in 2012 and what their views were in relation to all of these identity groups and issues. And I was surprised that 35% of white Obama voters held these attitudes that were more consistent with what Donald Trump was saying in 2016 than with what Hillary Clinton was saying. I did not expect those numbers to be that high. And it was really one of those moments where you run the table and you stop and you say, okay, you know, I've messed this up. I got to go back, download the data again, start from scratch. Because there's no way that's a big number. That can't be right. So that was one. The other one was probably the way we saw these racial attitudes playing out in the Republican primary, that it was your attitudes about groups that were sorting you among those candidates, but that in the Democratic primary, as much as people wanted to say and report on the fact that the Bernie bros were different than the Clinton supporters, they weren't. On their policy positions, they are the same. Where they differ is in their descriptive characteristics. So in the Democratic primary, the identity crisis is over who we are, not what we think about groups. So if you were a man or a woman, if you were old or young, if you were white or not white, that determined whether you were a Sanders or Clinton voter, not what you thought about groups.
So it was a different marker in a certain sense in the surprising results for the Democratic identity crisis.
Yeah, it was just identity playing a role in a different way, not through attitudes, but through descriptive characteristics of the person.
And did your co-authors find the same things surprising? Can you say?
I think we all did, especially the white Obama voter table. We were all pretty struck by that.
I would bet that you all were like, huh, I don't want to do that work again. That's a really unexpected outcome. So what are the three of you, if you're writing another book together or working another project, what are you working on now?
So everyone's kind of gone off on their own pet projects. And I'll start with that because Michael Tesler is literally writing a book about pit bulls. Nope. And the politicization and the racialization of the pit bull as a dog breed. That book is being published by Princeton University Press and I think is going to be out in the next year to year and a half.
Cool.
And John is working on a book on budgeting and the bureaucracy. And I think that I have two ideas that I'm kind of focusing on. And the one we talked about with a graduate student here at UCLA, we've been thinking about this idea of work identity. So what kind of social identity or even, you know, relational identity vis-a-vis your family members do you derive from the work you do? And what happens when that work gets changed or taken away? Are there political consequences of that? And then also, I really want to write a book on political authenticity.
So do I. So,
yeah, my colleagues in the humanities, they talk about authenticity all the time in evaluating music and art and literature and performance. And they have a whole framework for doing this that I would like to bring to bear on political candidates as performers. And really think about why it is that people say, I like Donald Trump because he says what he thinks and he's just going to stand up to those people and he doesn't care who he offends. And that is about, that's about authenticity. You know, he's not particularly sincere. He's not particularly original, but man, the guy is authentic. And in a way that Hillary Clinton was a great contrast to this, people thought she's always hedging. She is never really showing us what she really thinks. Why won't she just be honest about what she said to Wall Street, et cetera, et cetera? And so there are times when she can be very sincere, when she cries in that diner in 2008 during the nomination process. But she's not always sincere and not, no one sees her as authentic. And then maybe she's a little bit original because she's a woman, but these are sort of the concepts that I'm thinking about.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this question of authenticity, I know Julia Azari and Brendan Nyhan wrote about them during the election because the word was used a lot in the media. And I do think it has a gender component too that's really interesting to dig at.
Yeah, so that's what I'm thinking about.
So when you write that book, will you come back on the New Books podcast so I can talk to you about it?
Absolutely.
All right, cool. Thank you, Lynn Vavreck, very much for joining me today on the New Books Network to talk about Identity Crisis, which was recently published by Princeton University Press. Is there any particular place where one might pick up a copy of this book?
Well, you can always order it from Princeton University Press. They have an online interface. And I don't think you're going to find it in your airport bookstore when you're traveling for the holidays, but you can always get it from your favorite online vendor.
Thank you. Thank you for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. It's my pleasure.